The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Coming up...
I wouldn't be surprised if there are dark stars, dark planets, dark life, and that maybe would answer the question of why, after searching for 50 years, we've found no evidence of extraterrestrial life.
He has insight and erudition in equal measure. Writer, broadcaster and cosmologist Marcus Chown joins me to discuss his latest book, What a Wonderful World, One Man's Attempt to Explain the Big Stuff. Also on the show this week, I'll be joined by comedian and science presenter Helen Arney to wave a flag for Ada Lovelace Day, and we'll be talking 3D printing in space and how to build a lightsaber. Well, sort of. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. First, let me welcome my guests in the studio. Helen Arney, welcome back to the pod. You survived Edinburgh Fringe and the British Science Festival this summer, I take it?
I have. I say survived is one word. Yeah, I think it's probably the most appropriate.
What were you doing?
We were doing a show called Festival of the Spoken Nerd with my colleagues Matt Parker and Steve Mould, and another show called Domestic Science. So for 25 days in a row, I did 2-hour-long shows a day. And a lot of people learnt to love a lot of science.
Glad you're here in one piece. And welcome back to Observer Science editor Robin McKee.
Hi.
Helen, let's kick off with you. 3D printing in space?
Yes, this is the news from this week that NASA are preparing to launch the first 3D printer into space. And for me, thinking about owning a 3D printer, that feels like the most luxury, ludicrous, fun thing that I could ask for my Christmas list. And it might seem a bit bonkers to send a 3D printer into space, but it does make perfect sense. And it's taken quite a long time to develop this toaster-sized object. Because, of course, once you're up in the space station, you can't fix things unless you use whatever it was. Apollo 13 used duct tape and a bit of tinfoil or something to fix the mission, you know, ludicrous things. So this 3D printer completely revolutionizes how they actually stock the International Space Station and their missions there, because instead of having to take multiple spares for every single possible thing that could go wrong, if it's an appropriate thing, they can just print it out and use it right there and then. They just need the toaster-sized implement and they need the stuff to actually print. And this is kind of a game changer. Because it costs about $10,000 to take a pound of payload up into space. So taking a toaster up will taking the plastic toaster up will in the long run cost a lot less.
Isn't there a bit of a flaw in this thinking that it's a 3D printer and, as far as I know, they're only really good at making things out of plastic, and the space station isn't made out of plastic?
There are a lot of things within the space station that it's like any vehicle or a house or a car or anything. You're obviously not going to 3D print, well, not right now, perhaps in the future, you're not going to 3D print a solar panel. But when a light switch breaks, or when a cog or I'm just imagining it, but something, if a mechanical part of the water purification system, a cog, a rubber band, something like that can easily be replaced, they either need to take multiple spares or wait until the next transport comes up. And I just think this for me is one of those brilliant stories of sci-fi made real. I was a huge Red Dwarf fan when I was a teenager, and the thing I loved the most about it was the sarcastic vending machine. So all NASA need to do is, you know, they need to ask the Made in Space company to add a sarcastic voice to the 3D vending machine and get it to print out pizzas as well. It's the tipping point of the future I imagined when I was a sci-fi fan teenager, being able to print out anything you've ever imagined in space.
But don't forget, when I was a sci-fi enthusiast in my teens, we had 2001 come out, and we thought 2001 was supposed to have a space station. It's 2013, and all we've got is kind of, well, sort of a space station.
Do you know what you said?
Not happened.
I thought you were about to say, when I was reading sci-fi as a teenager, we still had dinosaurs roaming the planet. But then I thought that was what you were going to say. But
I think you know perfectly well humans and dinosaurs never intermingle. I think that's one of the first things you should know in a science show.
That is something that is apparently open to debate.
But seriously, are these 3D printers going to work in space? Or do they work in microgravity?
Well, this is what they've been testing out. This is what the news part of this story is, because this has been rumbling on for ages and ages and ages. And 3D printing is so hot. It's so exciting. It's, you know, the thing that everyone is using to just make little gadgets for their bikes or their iPads, you know. They have tested it now in parabolic flights on Earth. So planes taking off from Earth, going in a parabolic flight and simulating microgravity. And it has been difficult to make it work because convection works differently without gravity. Thermal conduction is different in space. So it is something they have had to develop. And finally, they have announced that, yes, they will definitely be taking them up there soon.
Because one of the things presumably you need is, I guess you have like liquid feedstocks, if you like, which aren't going to sit in a little container and drip down into the printer so they can be squirted onto a substrate or something.
From the look of it, it's much more like sort of piped icing rather than... I know there's some 3D printers that sort of... They use a sort of pot of liquid and the fully formed 3D object sort of rises out of the gloop because it's been shaped using...
Lasers. If in doubt, lasers.
Lasers. Where the lasers join, it fuses the gloop into something solid. But there are other ones now that they build up tiny layer upon layer upon layer. And it does look a little bit like sort of icing coming out of an icing bag. And you sort of pipe this pattern and each layer cools and then you can build up and build up and build up in any shape you like.
What is NASA's raison d'etre for doing this? What do they think they're going to... What is going to be better for doing this? Is it just it's lighter? You have less stuff kicking around on the space station? You can just send your bits up over a electromagnetic wave and print stuff out?
Yeah, that is the thing. Things that they haven't even considered might break or need repairing, can just zap to the printer and it will print it out up in space. Because just think about it, if all of these replaceable objects on the space station, all the things that are at risk of breaking quite easily, you would need a whole space station's worth of spares. So really it does decrease the amount of spares they have to store on the space station, the amount of money it costs to take stuff up. By the way, I tried to look up on the NASA website the cost per pound of payload and discovered that today that the NASA website is blocked.
It's not working, is it?
Yeah.
Like that. Yes, it is.
I find this one of the saddest things for me personally is that the Mars rover has stopped tweeting because of the government shutdown. I find this personally, I know there are many other effects, but me personally, that is the saddest thing about the shutdown and not being able to find out the exact current cost per payload.
I bet the cartridges are cost enormously, don't they? It's always the way with printers. You have the printer, you turn it on, it takes ages to decide it's actually going to do something, and then it says, "I'm out of colours, by the way, that'll be $50 for red."
And when it does break, and you know, you're just trying to do the usual run of Monday morning photocopying of new forks or spare toothbrush handles, you're going to have to wait for the guy from the printing fixer company to come out. You know, basically, you're just still waiting on IT. It's still going to be all the same problems.
Well, NASA can learn the hard way, like the rest of us have. Well, staying with the rather sci-fi theme, one of my favourite stories of the past week was the news that flew around the web that scientists had, of course, created, finally, a Jedi lightsaber. And this was obviously one of the most important stories around for scientists, although clearly no one has made a lightsaber. But we had a lot of fun playing around the idea that it may have happened. What really took place was it was a group at MIT and Harvard who had done something really quite impressive. It's probably one of the most complex experiments you can do in a lab. And I got one of the scientists, a guy called Ofer Furstenberg, a Harvard postdoc, to talk me through it after everybody had already written their stories about how a lightsaber had been made, including our good selves. And he said, well, basically what you start off with is a room that's 8 meters by 8 meters, and then you stick a load of tables in the middle. And then you actually build up a ton of equipment on these various tables. You have one which has a really big vacuum chamber on it. And then you have another table for a load of optics. And then you have another table, the biggest table, which is 3 or 4 meters long and 1 or 2 meters wide, which has all your lasers on. Not just one, has all of your lasers on. Okay, so It weighs a ton. And I asked him, can you clip it to your belt? And he just said, no, 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 no. Of course you cannot clip it to your belt. When you turn it on, it doesn't make a sort of noise. There's none of this. But what they did was really good. And it's beautiful, actually. What you do is you evacuate this vacuum chamber. You pump out the air. And then you squirt in a small amount of rubidium atoms. And then you use a laser to first cool them down. So you use the laser to interact with the atom cloud. And it just dampens down the vibrations. So you take it down to something like half a Kelvin, half a degree above absolute zero, which is colder than you get out in space. And it forms, you use another laser to confine them. And you confine them in a little cigar-shaped cloud, which is 0.1 millimeters long. And that length is actually the down the axis of the cigar. It's narrower than 0.1 millimeter. And then what you do is you take another laser and you fire in photons. And what happens that's quite lovely is a photon will go in. The first one will go and it'll excite a rubidium atom. That means it hits a rubidium atom, kicks up an electron to a really high energy level, to the point that the electron, the atom comes to effectively a thousandth of the time, a thousandth the size, because the electron goes up to such a high orbit. And it acts like an antenna. And another electron, another photon will come in and do the same to a nearby rubidium atom. And these kind of antennas, these excited electrons interfere with each other. They influence each other. And what happens is the photons actually go along, they kick up electrons, and then the electrons fall back down. They give their energy back to the photon. The photon basically jumps from atom to atom to atom through this cloud, giving up energy, receiving it again. But what happens is this produces a kind of a coupling up effect. So two photons nearby will form what they call a photonic molecule. And then they will pass out the other end, and they'll stop being a photonic molecule. But for the moment they are within this 0.1 millimeter cloud, these photons couple up. And because they called it photonic molecule, that led them to say, well, it's a bit like making a lightsaber. And to be fair, this comment came from the senior authors of the paper. And that was all you needed in media world, obviously, for everybody to write about it. So we immediately got looking for pictures of dueling Jedis. And this wasn't a very early study on some basic science. This was, we're making a lightsaber. But the kind of sad thing in a way is that it detracts from what was actually a really beautiful experiment. And they're talking about, you know, what nice things you could do. Maybe you would be able to make sort of these larger crystal type, almost crystal type structures out of light and things. You know, I mean, we're talking about terribly microscopic things again, but it's a fascinating bit of physics that got absolutely enormous coverage. And fair play to them, because it got coverage because they were talking about lightsabers. But it was fun. What did you make of that one, Helen?
Now you've told me so much more about the detail. I love that. You know, kids never grow up. I think scientists still retain that thing of being a kid who never grows up, who's just curious about things and just wants to play with awesome stuff. And so, yeah, it's so obvious that they wanted it. You know, if they could have made a lightsaber, they would have done. Instead of that, from the size of that lightsaber, it sounds like it could be sort of a lightsaber in a fight against, like, a gonorrhea bacteria or something. You know,
the intergalactic menace of gonorrhea.
Yeah, no, wow, something that small. I mean, if you're gonna have to get it to be in the right place. Just left a bit. Right now, fire. It doesn't feel like an effective weapon yet.
And you have to come walking into the room with this ton of equipment and say, actually, can you just move inside this vacuum chamber and put your arm quite close to that molecule, which is much smaller than a tenth of a millimeter.
It might sting a little bit.
And you probably just bounce off you, yeah. I mean, to be fair, the authors were saying, look, I don't know how a lightsaber works. It's made up. I don't know how George Lucas did it. but they said, look, if you want to cut some cheese or something, we've got great lasers for doing that already. The only thing you can't do is make them stop a meter from your hand.
Yeah.
It does raise an interesting point, though, because there will be lots of scientists who get really grumpy about this and say it trivializes science. But in fact, it got a very complicated bit of physics into national newspapers, well, into newspapers around the world. So, I mean, jolly good luck to them for finding a line there and for getting people like yourself to explain a very interesting and subtle set of physics. So, I mean, so to all those scientists who think that trivializes science, no, it doesn't. Shut up.
Robin, dare I ask, what was the story that caught your eye this week?
Just a very little one. I thought I would bring an element of sobriety to proceedings, but clearly a bit late. This is the story that appeared on Friday. Traffic fumes that which render the scent of flowers barely recognisable to honeybees. And is the latest in a sort of long list of bits of research that show just how hard our honeybees are time out there having it. Honeybees are more than slightly important. They're responsible for nearly all the fruit and vegetables, well, the fruit anyway, in this country. And without bees, we'd be in a very poor state. And yet all sorts of things are afflicting them, colony collapse disorder and these things. And now this news that traffic fumes, in particular nitrogen oxides, seem to destroy the scent of the flowers that they like to pollinate. And add just another little kind of note of worry about species. I did actually, one other thing that did attract me to the story is that the fact the head of the research was called about flowers was called Professor Poppy, but that really had nothing to do with it.
Well, there's nothing wrong with a bit of nominative determinism. When I looked at this story, I was thinking, well, how many of these bees and the flowers that they're pollinating are actually very close to heavy traffic areas? But when I drive down to, you go down to Cornwall, you try and get out to the coast in this country, the motorways will go past fields and fields of oilseed rape, which seems to be what the research was done on. So this is actually probably a meaningful effect.
I don't think they actually quantified it here, but it's certainly my sort of subjective feel that I don't think you're very far anywhere in this country now from traffic fumes.
Bees are amazing, and they have incredible senses of smell as well. And this is what is so astonishing about this, I think, is because I know that bees have amazing abilities to detect different smells. They've done tests where they've used them to detect explosives as an alternative to sniffer dogs. And this is astonishing for me that they're... incredible sense of smell could be so affected by something. It must be so significant for this to be a problem.
I like the idea that bees were strapped down and taught to associate with.
I don't know how they attach them. That is slightly contained. But they stick out their tongues for honey. For sugar solution.
Yes.
So they train them. So you've just got a little field of bees where they waft over some scents and see if they stick their tongue out.
It's strange. I mean, one of the things I find bees, to my mind, they're all incredibly friendly. And I think I'm just looking at the picture and I think it's because they're fairy. It's a simple psychology that we humans have, or it's a simple psychology that I have. But it's fairy, so therefore it must be nice.
Yeah, that is very interesting, because if you take off the fur, they suddenly become just
wasps.
Awkward, weird, waspy things.
Yeah. Here's to hair. Helen, you wanted to talk about Ada Lovelace Day.
Yes, this is the thing that's happening on the 15th of October. This is my gratuitous plug. I am involved in a thing called Ada Lovelace Day. It's an international celebration of women in science and technology. And rather than some recent furores that have been going on about there not being enough visible female science presenters, this is not about saying there aren't enough female science presenters. The Ada Lovelace Day is all about celebrating women who are out there doing science, who are talking about science, people in history who have done brilliant science but happen to be women and don't get enough people just cheering their corner. So that's what Ada Lovelace Day is, an international day of blogging. We also have live events, everything from Wikipedia editathons to tea parties happening all over the world. And we have a big event at Imperial College in London with a lineup of fantastic female speakers, everyone from geologists to biomaterials experts to hackers, and hackers in a sense of hack space, not kind of taking over the world hackers, although maybe they may be doing that in their spare time, I don't know, and they happen to all be women. It's something I get really, really passionate about, because every time I read a news article that says, where are all the women science presenters? Or, everyone just talks about the male science presenters, so I'm going to write a whole article that just talks about the male science presenters as well. It's much more about saying, look, there are some fantastic things. Let's cheer for the good stuff instead of trying to emphasise the unideal situation of inequality.
Tell us a bit about Ada.
Ada Lovelace was in, this is all very debatable, but it is argued that she was the first computer programmer, and she lived about 100 years before the first computer was actually made. She was a independently wealthy aristocratic woman. She was the daughter of Lord Byron. So she is a significant person. I think she is used a lot as a figurehead for being a woman out of her time who pursued her her love of knowledge, but also added this imagination of what is possible for human beings to achieve with this science and technology, not just the actual doing of it.
What's not to love? Imperial College London is hosting their Ada Lovelace Day on Tuesday the 15th of October, kicking off at 7 p.m. Thanks to Helen Arney and Robin McKee there. For all those stories, just go to the best science news site on the web, theguardian.com/science, and we'll have links to Helen's Ada Lovelace Day events on the blog for this show too. Marcus Chown is a gifted writer, best known for his books on cosmology and general science. The titles give you an idea of the warmth and wit of his writing, from his 2005 book Quantum Theory Cannot Hurt You, and We Need to Talk About Kelvin in 2009. His most recent book, What a Wonderful World, One Man's Attempt to Explain the Big Stuff, is a much more ambitious work, roaming from sex to finance to knotty questions about the brain and our understandings of dark matter. So it was a particular pleasure to have Marcus into the Guardian studios to discuss life, the universe, and everything. Marcus, you're well known for writing about physics, but this book is really different. What have you taken on this time?
Yeah, I've tried to write about everything from finance to thermodynamics, sex to special relativity, human evolution to holography. I've tried to write about how the world of the 21st century works. I mean, obviously, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. I haven't really covered everything. Think of it as Everything Volume 1.
So why?
I've got an absolutely fantastic editor and my publisher, Faber. He's called Neil Belton. And he said to me over lunch one day, what you do is you communicate physics to anyone, someone sitting on a number 25 bus or whatever. Why don't you use your skill in doing this to explain everything to everyone? When he said it, I thought, I was totally daunted. I thought, well, how can you possibly do that? How can you write about money and cell biology and the brain and quantum theory and all that kind of stuff? So I kind of put him off for about 2 years. But in the meantime, I did an iPad app called Solar System for iPad. And I had to write 120 stories about moons and planets and whatever in 9 weeks. So the only thing I could do was just leap in, start writing about things I knew about while thinking about what I should be researching and doing, next. And so that gave me the confidence to just really jump in, start doing some of the things that I didn't know anything about, phone up an economist, phone up a neuroscientist, something like that, and just get started.
You start with biology in humans, and that inevitably brings you straight away to some of the toughest questions we ask about ourselves. What is it to be human? What is consciousness? How did you get on with those?
Well, with the brain, for instance, this was very difficult because I wanted to know how the brain worked at the micro level, with neurotransmitters and all this kind of stuff, and also at the macro level, how we actually remember things and think. And it was very difficult to get people who knew about all of these things. And so it was very difficult to get an integrated picture. But I think I did, and I became fascinated by things like you probably know this, but the glutamate, which is the principal neurotransmitter. I thought, the brain is a modern thing, this is a new thing, was used for internal signaling by the first bacteria 3.8 billion years ago. And I thought that the electrical signaling in the brain, that's got to be a modern invention. But in fact, the earliest cells had the problem of pumping out things like salts across their membranes, which charged them up. And so they could create the equivalent of a charged Mexican wave around their membranes. And there's a single-celled organism called paramecium that does this. If it bumps into an obstacle, this little Mexican wave goes around it, and it's kind of little, they're called flagella, I think, causes the thing to swim away. So I was completely fascinated that nature has co-opted all these things, which are amazingly ancient, into this modern thing, the human brain.
From humans, you move on to technology and you go through various technologies. You then go on to how the Earth works, the geosciences, and then you get on to more familiar territory for you of fundamental physics and cosmology. But you've already mentioned that along the way you cover money and capitalism. Why did those things catch your eye, and what did you learn about those yourself along the way?
Why? Because I think the world is motivated by, well, most people are motivated by a few things: money, sex, all these kind of things. I wrote about sex, by the way. And I just thought, I don't understand it. You know, I mean, particularly after the 2008 financial crash, I don't know what's going on, you know. And I really wanted to understand money at a very fundamental level. I once did a radio program with Andy Hamilton, who's a comedy writer, and he interviewed me about gravity, and he asked me questions that I would never have even thought of asking. You know, like, is there a gravitational force between me and you? Is there a gravitational force between me and the coins in my pocket? So I was trying to ask about the financial system at that absolutely toddler level. And I don't need to know about leverage and all the complex things. I just wanted to know the very, very simple, you know, money, how did it arise? So that was really my approach.
And did you get to the point where you understand it? Do you understand what caused the crash? Do you understand how money is made now?
Well, money is an invention. You know, it is created. I mean, Henry Ford said that if people knew how money was created, there'd be a riot before breakfast. Basically, money is created by just adding a zero on a number on a computer. That's how money is made. But I mean, I got some insight into the financial crash. I mean, one of the most shocking things is these things called collateralized debt obligations were very important in the collapse of world economies. And basically, these were, you know, bundled together all these dodgy mortgages into what are called collateralized debt obligations, thousands and tens of thousands of them, and then get these bundles and put them into bundles, and they're called collateralized debt obligations squared. Now, what amazed me is to understand a single one of these CDO squares, you would need to read 1 billion pages of documentation. So these things were created specifically to be opaque, so that people would not realise that they were actually buying these dodgy things. Now, interestingly, I talked to Harjun Chang, who's an economist at Cambridge University. He also wrote a fantastic book called 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism. And he had a very interesting idea. He said, in medicine, we test a drug for maybe 5 years or whatever in animals. And when it's safe, we think it's safe, we release it into the wild. He thinks these dodgy financial instruments, they should be tested as well, just like drugs. They should be tested in a virtual environment, maybe for 5 years, only if they're safe, only if they don't destabilize the virtual financial system, should they be released. And I mean, that seems just an incredibly sensible idea.
So we could have randomized control studies for financial instruments to see if they're safe to unleash on the world.
Absolutely. And I can't see that any regulation that's happened since the crash of 2008 will prevent the creation of these amazingly dodgy financial vehicles.
I have this picture of you going around taking on all these topics and using a very sort of reductionist attitude to say, I have to get down to the very basics, as you know, your physics training may tend you towards that, and trying to understand things from the bottom up. And is that what happened? And did that kind of thing work? Or did you find yourself in the territory where actually you need to take a different approach, that maybe that sort of reductionist attitude doesn't work?
It seemed to work. I have to say, it seemed to work. One of the problems with things like economics is that there's a lot of opinion. You know, I mean, in physics, there isn't much opinion. I mean, you know, most of people agree on most facts, and it's very similar in biology and in most sciences. So what made writing about some of these subjects very difficult is just, you know, trying to find the real foundations, the things that everyone would agree on.
When you're going through this book, doing the research for it, you must have presumably come to points where you think, if only we knew more about that, if only there was more I could understand and then explain. And I'm interested in where these areas were, where we're just crying out for more understanding.
It's very interesting you say that, because I wrote a chapter on cosmology, you know, our theory of the universe. And my editor, when he read it, said, this is rubbish, Marcus. And I thought, oh my God, what have I done? You know, have I written a completely rubbish chapter? No. He was commenting on the science. And of course, he's absolutely right. It is rubbish. I mean, only 2% of the mass of the universe have we actually seen. You know, 73% is this stuff called dark energy, which is invisible, fills all the space, it's got repulsive gravity, no one's got any idea what it is. About another 23-24% is dark matter, no one knows what that is. We've based this fantastic edifice of Big Bang cosmology on the 2% that we can see. I mean, imagine if biologists, imagine if Darwin came up with a theory of evolution, but he only knew about fleas and dolphins, but he didn't know about trees or any of the other things. And there's some enormously big idea missing. So with the dark energy, for instance, which is the energy of basically of empty space, if we use quantum theory, which is our very best description of matter, to predict the energy of empty space, the vacuum, we get a number which is 1 followed by 120 zeros bigger than what we observe. And that's the biggest discrepancy between a prediction and observation in the history of science. It's telling us that something is desperately, desperately wrong. That excites me. If you think of the standard Big Bang model, it's got all these things bolted on now. It's got dark energy bolted on. It's got dark matter bolted on. It's got inflation bolted on. It's not a seamless whole. It's a horrible, rickety structure. And something huge, some huge idea is missing, which hopefully we'll get within the next 10 years. But it could completely change our picture of physics and the universe.
And where do you think looks promising for those answers to come from?
Haven't got the slightest idea. I've always been quite interested in MOND, modified Newtonian dynamics, which is very interesting because in the mid 80s, an Israeli physicist called Mordecai Milgram looked at the speed at which stars were orbiting in spiral galaxies, and he realised that there was a single formula that described the motion of stars in every single spiral galaxy, and it involved gravity actually changing at a certain very low acceleration. Gravity changes to a different form, so it doesn't drop off with what we call an inverse square law. It drops off in a slightly less dramatically. The competing model is that the stars we're seeing orbiting in galaxies are being whirled around by invisible dark matter. But you have to put a different amount of dark matter in every single galaxy, and it has to have a different distribution. So even if you're just thinking about economy, MOND is very interesting. MOND is correct as an empirical formula, but nobody knows if there's any deeper physics beneath it. So it's kind of hinting at something very interesting. Because if you have ordinary matter and dark matter in the Big Bang congealing into galaxies, the process of galaxy formation is very, very chaotic. You get lots of blobs of material that hit each other and accrete. So it's very hard to imagine how this amazingly chaotic process, which produces the Milky Way, Andromeda, and all these other galaxies, ends up in this wonderful, unified MOND formula. So there's something really interesting there. But a big minority of astronomers believe in it, but the majority don't.
When you're talking about dark matter there, were you saying that the constituents of the dark matter have to be different in different galaxies, or just that, because I don't know really if dark matter would be assumed to be one particle type, or whether there may be different particle types within the dark matter?
Well, I mean, right from the moment I ever heard about dark matter, it occurred to me that everything we know about ordinary matter is complex. You know, there isn't one type of atom. There's 92 different types of atoms. And by combining those in different ways, like Lego bricks, you can make a rose or a baby or a tree or whatever. So it struck me immediately that it would be extremely unusual if the dark matter consisted of just one type of particle. But of course, that is what physicists have pursued, you know, and they've God knows why. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of complexity there. I wouldn't be surprised if there are dark stars, dark planets, dark life. And that maybe would answer the question of why we, after searching for 50 years, we found no evidence of extraterrestrial life, because it's in the dark sector.
Could there be more than one dark force? Could there be dark forces which are helping this dark matter interact?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, everything we know about normal matter is that complex forces hold it together, from, you know, basically electric forces, but, you know, van der Waals forces, all these kind of things. It really surprised me if there weren't complex forces involved as well. But anyway, what you can say about dark matter is that it's been we haven't found it. I mean, you know, there have been constant predictions that we would find it at the Large Hadron Collider. We haven't found it. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder, will it end up as the ether of the 21st century? You know, everyone was absolutely convinced that light rippled through this medium, this invisible medium called the ether. This was the late 19th century. And obviously Einstein showed life was, sorry, electromagnetic waves of light was self-supporting. You didn't need a medium. Now, incredibly, we have many types of ether. You know, we've introduced dark energy, dark matter. Will they just vanish? Will people laugh in future decades?
You're going to get a lot of letters written in green biro now, Marcus.
I will.
The one thing that worries me about your book, and it worries me for you, is that you've now explained everything. Does that mean the end of your publishing career?
Well, no, because I like to write. I've written fiction, I've written children's fiction, I've written science fiction. I just like writing, and I really haven't written about everything, as I said. It's rather tongue-in-cheek, as I say. It is volume one. I'm not intending to write a volume two, but no. There's plenty of other things to write.
What a Wonderful World is published by Faber and out now in all good on and offline bookshops. That's all we have for you this week. Remember, for the latest science news day or night, go to theguardian.com/science. But for now, many thanks for listening. It's goodbye from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps. See you next time.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.